Fancy a game?
Grass grows, birds fly, sun shines, and brother, I hurt people.
You know what I think I'm gonna do then? I'm gonna take this right foot, and I'm gonna whop you on that side of your face. And you wanna know something? There's not a damn thing you're gonna be able to do about it.
Medically, I don't really know what that means, but it seems to give me a lot of energy.
It's Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff.
Hello! At least they didn't lose by exactly 17 points. Marc-Andre Fleury wasn't any good either over the weekend. I didn't think that was allowed. We do finally have the return of Jesus Lopez, Spanish goal calls for the Golden Knights. It feels like it's been an eternity. We also have Lights FC tickets that we're going to give away. Gerard Gallant's finally coaching. He's doing like coaching moves and things. He didn't do that like at all for a whole season and a half almost. He's doing it now. But we start with UNLV because this might be the worst defensive team in UNLV history. I wrote a story on the defensive problems. You can read it at lvsportsnetwork.com, and we'll get into a lot of these defensive issues. On the number side of it, since KenPom began back in 2001-2002, UNLV has never had a team finish outside the top 200 in defensive efficiency. This year, they are 238. Even in Marvin Menzies' first year, where he just sort of cobbled together an assortment of players in May and June, he still had a better defensive efficiency. They were 184 that year. Even last year, when Brandon McCoy couldn't be on the floor in close games because he couldn't defend anybody, UNLV's defense was still better. They were 174 that year. Now they're 238. Add on to that, by the way, KenPom, track strength of schedule by offense and defense. So basically how good are the offenses you've played, how good are the defenses you've played. And this is the easiest offensive schedule UNLV's ever played, meaning the opposing offenses are very, very bad. So not only are they bad on defense, they're also not playing very good offensive teams for the most part. So again, possibly this, and these numbers just go back to the 2001-2002 season, possibly the worst defensive team in UNLV history. Now, as far as what's happening with this team, I'm going to give you a timeline of Mountain West play, because UNLV has used a lot of different defenses. Defenses that Marvin Menzies calls junk defenses, and he's mainly referring to sort of the face guarding that they used earlier in conference play against New Mexico, Wyoming, San Diego State. It worked against New Mexico and Wyoming. But when they tried it against San Diego State, they tried to face guard Devin Watson, the point guard at San Diego State. Jalen McDaniels went for 30 points because San Diego State has more than one good player on their roster. So if you face guard one guy, somebody else has more chances, more space to score. That's what Jalen McDaniels did. So they go and play Utah State, and Marvin Menzies made a choice. He made a decision that is for the future. He decided to ditch the junk defenses, and he wanted to play straight up. He wanted to play the way that Marvin Menzies would prefer to play defense, right? If he had his ideal team, he's like, we're going to play this style of defense that Marvin Menzies wants to coach, even if it's not the best way for that particular team to defend in that particular game. So the way Menzies wants to play is half-court man-to-man defense with the midline concept. And the midline concept, it's used in high school a lot. My high school coach ran it. That's not necessarily a slight on it, because Virginia runs it too, and Virginia's probably been the best defensive team in college basketball for the last 5 years.
And horrible to watch.
Yeah, terrible. But what they're terrible because of their offense, though, not because they're because they're really slow on offense. The defense is, they're fine. It's just the offense. They're like, yeah, let's just slow down. But what the midline defense is, it's basically an overhelp type of defense. When the ball is on one side of the floor, the weak side defender's job is to get to the middle of the floor. They're to get to the midline. So they need to get to the paint. Imagine there's a line drawn down the middle of the floor. That's where the weak side defenders are supposed to be. It's a good defense for preventing layups. You don't tend to give up very many layups when you run this defense, because even if someone gets beat off the dribble, even if you have a blown ball screen coverage, there's usually one or two guys just standing in the way.
There's just bodies in the way.
They're just there. So it tends to prevent layups. It does give up threes because it stresses quality closeouts from your defenders, because when the ball gets skipped to the other side of the floor. If somebody does get in the lane and kicks it out, now all of a sudden these guys that are defending in the paint, they've got to sprint out to the three-point line and try to contest a shot. It's very hard to do. It's hard to do that. So that's where the problems come in, is you give up open threes. Virginia, almost every single year, gives up more threes than the average college basketball team. UNLV's biggest problem overall is recognition, though. Like, regardless of scheme, it's recognition. They don't read things well. They don't read things quickly. Guys are always late to help side, and it leaves UNLV in a scramble mode. Menzies made a point about guys being, actually, he thought they were in the right position more often than not against Fresno State, but were making poor reads as to, you know, when they needed to help and when they needed to stay closer to their man. You saw this, not in the half court, but you saw this in transition defense against Fresno State, where UNLV was slow matching up, and it just led to a handful of open threes in the first half for Fresno State. But the big problem for UNLV overall, that was a specific problem for Fresno State, but the big problem overall is their half-court defense, and specifically their ball screen defense. Because UNLV, they have this midline concept where guys are going to overhelp. They use their ball screen defense, what they use is a hard hedge. And so what that means is, big man goes to set a screen, Mbaki Zhang follows him out there. When the ball handler comes off that screen, Mbaki Zhang's job is to make the ball handler dribble backwards. They do not want the ball handler turning the corner on the screen and getting into the lane. So Mbaki Zhang's job is to make the ball handler dribble backwards. The problem for UNLV is they don't do that often enough. They don't do that well enough. And so what happens is, because that's Mbaki Zhang's job, the ball handler, if he's quick enough, will just get a step on Mbaki Zhang, and Zhang can no longer make him go backwards, and now he's just trying to stretch him out, just trying to make him go laterally instead of towards the basket. And when that happens, the man who set the screen now rolls to the basket, and Mbaki Zhang's like 10 feet away from him. And he can't recover to it in time. And so the end result is, sometimes the ball gets thrown into the roll man, sometimes they just skip the roll man, but the end result is those midline defenders now have to pick up the roll man because Zhang can't get there in time when they pass it to him. And because they have the midline defenders there, the ball often gets kicked out to the three-point line where those midline defenders are supposed to be normally, and there's wide open threes. And that's the ultimate problem for UNLV. So they have this midline defense, which isn't a bad defense by any means, but coupled with this ball screen defense and the fact that UNLV can't actually execute it very well, they run into giving up open threes all the time. You have a question?
Yes, okay. I was just going to ask how he's not 100%. Mbaki's not 100% yet.
I would guess not. But this has been a problem. I mean, this was a problem last year. Like, he wasn't great at it last season either.
Okay. Like that's my question. It's like, okay, he needs to force a guy to dribble backwards, but if that guy gets a step on him, well, his injury was ankle-related, that's going to be a little bit of a problem.
And I use Mbaki Zhang because he's the starting center. It's not just Zhang. Like, when JTT's in there, same problems. Nick Blair even sometimes, when they've used him at center, same sort of issues. What I would like to see UNLV do, they don't have to abandon the midline concept, but their ball screen defense, they need to be less aggressive with it. Like, they don't, because usually when you use a hedging ball screen defense, Mbaki Zhang, his job is to make the guy dribble backwards, but he also usually, you want to keep a hand on the guy that's going to roll to the basket. That way you never really lose contact. That way you're never far away from him and you can always recover back to it. They don't do that. They tell Mbaki Zhang, like, your job is to make the guy dribble backwards at all costs. So I would like to see them be a little bit less aggressive with that, because that tends to hurt them a lot. The other thing I would like to see them do is what Fresno State did defensively on ball screens. And it's basically a sagging type of ball screen where when the screen is set, the big man doesn't come out to the three-point line. He sort of stays back in the lane, and his job is now to take away a layup, whoever it is. If it's the ball handler, he comes off the screen and drives in the lane, or if they throw it to the roll man going to the basket, the big man's job, he stays closer to the basket, so it doesn't matter who gets there. His job is just simply, don't let them get a layup. And I like that better because it fits Mbaki Zhang much better, because the closer he is to the basket, the better he is as a defender. So if you can leave him in the lane more often, I think it's just going to make him a better defender. The other part of that is the guard has to go over the top of the screen to take away the three-pointer off the screen. UNLV's guards don't have a ton of length. Like, having length helps in that department, so that could be an area where they struggle. The biggest problem, though, is if the guy setting a screen is a three-point shooter. Because when you have your big man sagging the lane, all he has to do is set the screen, pop to the three-point line, he's wide open. Now, Fresno State, their big man doesn't shoot threes. I think Nate Grimes has taken, like, 13 threes all season. He's made, like, two of them. So he's the perfect guy to run that defense against because he's not going to pop to the three-point line. Some team, like, it won't work against Air Force because Air Force is going to put five shooters out there. It's not going to work on Tuesday, that type of defense. But there's a lot of Mountain West teams. Yes, teams in this conference have guys that shoot all over the floor, but a lot of teams, their five-man doesn't shoot threes. And so you can run that defense. That's what I'd like to see. But that is sort of where this team is at defensively. They are, to me, the biggest problem is they don't read and react quick enough. Like, it's not that they're physically slow. It's that they're almost, like, mentally slow in reading what the other team is doing. They don't pick up what the other team is doing quick enough. And even when it's just as simple as sort of semi-transition, it's like, oh, who do we pick up in transition? Oh, we didn't. And it's an open three. So that, to me, is the biggest problem. And it goes to Marvin Menzies. He's talked about after the game against Fresno State about needing more reps. And, you know, that's I asked him, you know, all right, what's the key to your defense getting better for the rest of the season? And he said needing more reps, which is, I don't know, that's interesting to me because this is not a complicated defense.
See, I was actually just going to ask, is that something you could teach them by, like, sitting there and watching film and over and over again, or is it something like...
I mean, I would guess... Actually, let's play this audio from Menzies because he kind of talks about a little bit about how players learn differently. Like, they're, I guess, just like you're in school, audio or visual type learners. But let's play... And actually, this audio... A lot of people didn't like this quote from Marvin Menzies because it seems like he's throwing his players under the bus.
Now, our system is good, and it's just got to get embraced by the guys, and they just got to keep hearing it. You know, one of the coaches asked me, I forget what it was, I told him to give some instruction, and he said, I told him, he said, how many times do I have to tell him? I said, well, you got to tell him until he gets it, right? Didn't say it frustrated, but like, I'm telling him over and over, well, that's not all there is to teaching. You got to find out how they learn.
Sounds like more he threw his coach under the bus.
That too. I don't know. When I heard that, like, sitting there watching or Marvin Menzies talk, I didn't feel like he was throwing people under the bus. I mean, but he is. I mean, that is what he's doing when he's saying, no, our coaching's fine. System's great. You just got to get these guys to figure it out. The thing with Marvin Menzies, though, is that, like, that's his overall belief, period. Like, he honestly believes, like, I'm a great coach. I know, like, all the time, he'll say, I'm good. I know what I'm doing. I know how to do this. We just got to get everybody else on board. That's his mindset towards it. And, I mean, he's been a college basketball coach for over a decade now. I'd imagine they all have that mindset to some degree. But a lot of people didn't like that quote just because it seems like they lose by 18 points and he's saying, oh, no, what I'm coaching is good. It's just the players aren't doing it right, which they aren't.
And, I mean, not to slightly go on the other side of this, you are trying to teach defense to people who've played the game for 5 years. That's one of the things, the one game I've gotten to go out and watch, he's legitimately yelling some of the time, like, that's your guy, you go cover him. And it's sort of like, so wait, do they really just not know who they're supposed to guard?
That's just because they were confused about which Martin twin they're supposed to guard.
Okay, well, that's fair.
The thing, though, is, like, it's...
Ask the ref, could you tie, like a ribbon around one of them?
The thing, though, about, like, needing them to embrace it and them needing more reps is just... It's not a complicated defense. Like, this is one of the most basic defensive principles in basketball. So it's not complex. You just... If the ball's on the side of the floor, you get to the middle of the floor, and then you've got to close out well to your man on the three-point line. That's it. Like, that's the tenets of the defense, and... I mean, here's the thing. Marvin Menzies, I do like Marvin Menzies is coaching for the future with this move. And when I say future, I mean Mountain West Tournament, not, you know, 4 years down the road. He's coaching for the future because basically what I think his thought process was before the Utah State game was, we suck at defense. The only way we're going to be good at defense is if we start running the defense that I want to run and just learn through the growing pains. And maybe by the time Mountain West play comes along, they'll be better at it, and they won't be the worst defensive team in UNLV history. I like that idea because they're not a good defensive team, and playing a junk defense against Utah State's not going to get you anywhere anyway. So I like that idea. I do wish he would apply it to other parts of his coaching, though, like Bryce Hamilton's minutes. Like, the team sucks at defense. The reason Bryce Hamilton's not playing is because he's not any good at defense. Okay, put him out there, too. It can't get much worse. Like, let Bryce Hamilton, like, learn through the growing pain. Like, have the growing pains with Bryce Hamilton throughout the season. And maybe by the time Mountain West Tournament or even just next season rolls around, he's a much better defender. I don't know. We'll see. But I don't mind the thought process of, hey, let's just – we're going to get torched a lot, but we're going to put this defense in, and hopefully by the time Mountain West play comes around – it'll be better. Totally correct. Brought to you by Boyd Gaming. Make sure you have the Be Connected Sports app downloaded. When you sign up for a new phone account, you can get $50 to wager. It's the Be Connected Sports app from Boyd Gaming.
Get in touch with the show on Twitter at @Bischoff_Tyler.
Hey, it's Tyler Bischoff. Want the easiest way to bet on sports in Las Vegas? Download the Be Connected Sports app for free from the Apple or Google Play stores. Then head to your favorite Boyd location like the Orleans, Gold Coast, or Sun Coast to create an account. And with just a $100 deposit, you'll get a free $50 to wager. Then you'll be able to bet before or during the games you love to watch. Plus, if you use Pay Near Me, depositing money into your account can be done at 7-Elevens, Family Dollar Stores, or CVS Pharmacy. It's the Be Connected Sports app from Boyd Gaming.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants.
No, I don't want to go to a party in your pants.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants!
Bischoff's Briefs.
Very well.
Chet Buchanan is trying to shame UNLV fans into standing for the fight song.
All right. This is what the show should actually be about. Should have led with this instead of ball screen defense radio. I enjoyed my ball screen defense radio, though.
I enjoyed your article when I read it, so.
So, first media timeout of every game, the band plays the fight song. Chet Buchanan, the returned MC at Thomas & Mack, has made it his goal to get everyone in Thomas & Mack standing for the fight song. They don't. To paraphrase what he said as the fight song was starting, he basically told everyone to stand for the fight song, or you can't complain about other fans not showing up for the game.
Are those mutually exclusive?
No. It's like when people say you can't complain about something in the country if you didn't vote. It's the same principle there.
Yeah. No, yeah, that's, I mean, technically you're allowed to complain about anything. Yeah, yeah, this is...
So...
What?
I very much enjoy the idea of telling the few fans that do show up they aren't good enough fans because they're not standing for the fight song. I very much enjoy that. I do feel bad for Chet, though. Because his job, like, they brought him back, and his job is to make Thomas & Mack fun and exciting atmosphere, and there's nobody there.
Well, I'm not gonna lie, he's a massive improvement.
Yes, oh, no doubt about it.
And it's still
no
just
doubt
like,
about it.
No, dude, we're cool with you. Why are you mad at us?
Like, oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, bringing Chet back was good. It was a very good thing they did. But his the problem is the only time people get excited is like when the refs are biased against UNLV. Like that's it. Like I swear, the loudest Thomas & Mack has been was against Fresno State when the foul count was 7-1 against UNLV, and the fans were losing it on the refs.
They were all
good calls though.
Well, yeah, no duh. Sorry, I just assume they're all good calls. I didn't have access to Facebook or wherever I was supposed to watch the game.
ESPN3. It wasn't Facebook. Would have been cooler on Facebook.
That way I could see I was one of 57 people.
That's right. That's what I like about Facebook. The emojis got to go. You'll see emojis fly across your screen when they're on Facebook, but you can interact with people.
I have a weird tangential story that we shouldn't get to, so let's move on.
The refs had a UNLV student kicked out of the game.
Yeah, so this...
Was it Fat Eeyore?
I don't know. This is according to Adam Hill. I missed it, and I'm disappointed. Apparently, it's a whole thing. But apparently, the refs, they got some UNLV admin involved. They walked over and, like, pointed at a fan, and then security escorted him out. Yeah, I didn't see it. This is just what Adam Hill had said. So, at least the fans impacted the game?
Yeah, they made the refs mad.
Yeah.
Exactly what you're supposed to do.
Exactly. Yeah, I don't know. I'm curious what, like, what's the line for a ref to kick somebody out of a game?
Honestly, I think it should be lower than it is. Like, I feel like at one of the things I enjoy most about, like, going to a baseball game is if the ump just stands up and just points at a fan and throws them out of the game.
So you want fans thrown out of games?
If you're being an obnoxious dick, yeah, but get out of here.
I guess it depends on what you're saying. Like, if you're just loudly complaining that the ref's calls suck,
that's not doing any, like,
you should be good. Like, you should not be kicked out for telling the ref his calls suck. Now,
if you,
there's a line somewhere, if you start insulting the ref personally, maybe. Depends on what it is. Maybe. But, yeah. Like, if it's just like, hey, your calls suck, or, you know, get off your knees, you're blowing the game, or something like that. Like, no. You gotta let it. That guy gets to stay. So I wish I knew. I wish I knew. But we don't, unfortunately. But yeah, the fans made an impact. Biggest impact of the year for UNLV student section.
Fat Ewart threatening to beat up a Martin twin.
Noah Robotham had 8 points and 7 assists against Fresno State.
So shut down Robotham's scoring, you shut down UNLV's offense. Kind of holds true. They had a somewhat efficient game. It wasn't the worst offensive game, but he was only 3-7 from the floor. He only attempted 3 threes, made just one of them, and he only had 1 free throw attempt as well. The 7 assists is a good number. But overall, Robotham needs to be an efficient scorer, and 8 points on 3 of 7 shooting is not being an efficient scorer. So, again, it's kind of strange, but when Noah Robotham doesn't have a good offensive game, UNLV literally has no chance to win.
Eric Winalda left the UNLV game at halftime.
Winalda's going to join us tomorrow.
Fair weather.
Exactly. He originally tweeted a photo of the Thomas and Mac and said, "So, I'm at your hang at Bischoff, Tyler, and I don't know one of these guys. Using your logic, should I just leave?" He did leave at halftime.
Yeah.
But he tweeted this afterwards. "I left at halftime actually because we had a preseason game. We won 6-1. How did the basketball game go?"
They had a preseason game?
Yeah, they played some amateur team, and he's bragging about beating them 6-1. A lot of people thought Eric Winalda was taking shots at UNLV for losing.
I think he's confused about your stance and you within the UNLV media community. But at the same time, yeah, he didn't phrase that well.
He's
trying to take a shot at you, and his intention seems like he pulled a Dick Cheney and accidentally shot his friend in the face.
His intention was to take a shot at me because I have covered UNLV games rather than attend Las Vegas Lights games so far. He doesn't like that. But in the process, he took out UNLV because they lost by 18 points to Fresno State. So, and he said he doesn't know any of their players. But I thoroughly enjoy Eric Winalda trying to trash talk me and end up getting yelled at by other people. Like, just let him light himself on fire. I don't have to do anything. He just lights himself on fire on Twitter. It's great.
Do you want to preview any of the, like, do you want to preview the ticket giveaway
now?
Yeah,
we'll do it later.
All right.
Show plan on the air. John Merrill scored a shorthanded goal.
The guy who falls down?
Yeah, he's been good. He has 2 goals this season, 1 at even strength, 1 shorthanded. So that doesn't happen too often. He really was just cleaning up a 2-on-1 chance that Riley Smith and William Carlson had, and the puck just sort of squirted back through the slot, and Merrill was there, and he shot. By the way, excellent job from John Merrill to score on a wide-open net, because in hockey, this happens all of the time. The goalie is out of position, right? He's, like, laying on the ice, or he's on the other side of the net, and somehow players in the NHL shoot the puck straight into the goalie. They've got half the net to shoot at, and they shoot it straight into the goalie, and we always are like, what a save! And it's like, no, the guy had half a net to shoot at, and he shot it into the goalie's face. That is not a good save. That is a terrible shot. So credit to John Merrill for not taking a terrible shot and putting it in the net. Shorthanded numbers this year, by the way. Golden Knights are tied for 3rd in the NHL with 7 shorthanded goals. Calgary has 16, by the way, to lead the league. That's ridiculous. Arizona has 12. The Golden Knights, they only need one more to tie last season's mark of 8 shorthanded goals. They were 11th overall last year, short angles. So since they've been a team, they're one of the best shorthanded scoring teams in hockey.
Kyrie Walker attended UNLV and Fresno State on Saturday.
So that is according to Mike Grimala of the Las Vegas Sun. Walker is a five-star recruit in the class of 2020. Apparently, he's considering reclassifying to the 2019 class, which would make him a freshman in college next year if he were to do that. Walker has a lot of offers, but he does not have sort of the blue bloods for he's a top 15 player. His offers, best offers are probably Memphis, Arizona, Arizona State, Nevada. It's a good list, but it's not Kansas, Kentucky, Duke, North Carolina top type of list. So the thought process there is UNLV doesn't have to beat out the best teams in the country to get a five-star recruit. They just got to beat out, you know, some of the best teams in the West, and West Coast basketball this year is a sad, sad state. So UNLV could have a shot. The fun part about Walker is if he reclassifies to 2019, because first off, UNLV would have to open up another scholarship, right? They already have two guys signed. They only have two seniors leaving. Justin could be coming back, so they have to already open a scholarship for Justin. If the Walker comes and he's 2019, they got to find another scholarship to open. I'm sure people will transfer. It's college basketball, but UNLV will need players to transfer. They already need one. They need two if he comes back. But the fun part is it changes the idea of what next season is for UNLV, because we've talked a lot this year about, you know, this is sort of the core you get for next year for UNLV basketball. There'll be two three-star freshmen coming in that could help, but this is sort of what you get. You got to hope this improves and becomes a better team in the Mountain West. If all of a sudden you get a five-star kid to come in as a freshman, he could be your best player next year, and that gives you more optimism for next season being, you know, an NCAA tournament type season, because all of a sudden you could have, it might only be a one-year setup, but you could have Kyrie Walker coming. He's your best player. Shakur Justin comes back for 1 year. He's your second best player. And now Amori Hardy and Bryce Hamilton and Joel Tomboy, they can be that second tier of good players. And that's a lot more optimistic than you need Hardy and Tomboy to be the best two players on the team for a team that's going to go to the NCAA tournament. It just doesn't seem that likely.
Nevada was listed as a 4 seed in the NCAA tournament sneak peek.
So the NCAA does this sneak peek, let you see how they would seed the top 16 teams in the country. Nevada was the 14th best team and a 4 seed, and that sucks for Nevada because they have no margin of error. Eli Betker, Mountain West Wire, he tweeted out a nice little table comparing the top 16 teams, and they have the new quadrant system in college basketball to try to measure quality wins. So quadrant one is, there's a home and road, like where you play the game adjustment. But quadrant one basically is top 50 wins is kind of how you're supposed to look at it. But like Utah State's not a top 50 team, but if you play at Utah State, it counts as a quadrant one game because it's harder to play on the road. So Nevada doesn't have a quadrant one win. They also don't have a quadrant one loss. They have not played a quadrant one game this year. The other 16 teams, Houston is 3-1. That's the next fewest amount of quadrant one games played. So like Nevada, they might only play one quadrant one game all year. They go to Utah State later on, and that's still a maybe. By the end of the year, that could not be a quadrant one game. So they have no margin for error. If they lose a game at any point in Mountain West play, they can't do anything to impress the NCAA tournament selection committee. Like, nothing they can do the rest of the season is going to be impressive. So they're sort of locked in here, and I got to hope other teams sort of suck and fall below them. It's what it is, because they can't, like, they don't have a game that they can play and really impress the selection committee. Like, Utah State's a bubble team, and that's the biggest game they have the rest of the way. So it sucks for them. Like, if they lose, they could fall to 5, 6, 7 seed.
All right, you have two choices of Jared briefs. Which one do you want, the media one or the Kyler Murray one?
Let's go Kyler Murray.
Kyler Murray will not be playing for the Aviators this season.
That's disappointing.
Yeah, I know. He tweeted it out. I think right before we went on the air, he tweeted out, "I've always wanted to be an NFL quarterback, and so I'm going to focus on my dream."
I am glad, though, actually, that he's going to do football. Because I've much more interest in Kyler Murray, NFL quarterback, than Kyler Murray, AAA outfielder.
Yeah.
Even though he'd be here, which I guess would be interesting, but way more interested in Kyler Murray trying to be an NFL quarterback than Kyler Murray trying to be a Major League Baseball outfielder.
I'm just not a huge... I don't know. He seems so small.
I don't care. John Gruden can draft him.
Oh, no, I'd be down for that.
That'd be so much fun.
He's in... and I would love him to try to be a two-sport athlete then.
That too.
Then
that would be great.
He's like, okay, guys, I got to run over to the Summerlin ballpark, but then I'll be back for tape. No?
Two-star athlete in AAA baseball?
Yeah.
That'll be good. Can he make how much money do you make playing AAA baseball? I guess he'd have a major league contract, wouldn't he?
Well, no, because they're... Well, it's that's part
of the
problem.
Well, the A's are probably like, F you. Go away.
I don't know. You spent your first round pick on him.
Right, and now he's saying he wants to play football, so they're like, get out of here. We're tired of you.
I don't think that...
That's how Mark Davis does things, I'm sorry. I just assume all teams run their organization that way. Technically correct. Have you ever wondered what it looks like inside Bischoff's briefs? Thanks to Manscaped.com, it looks phenomenal. Manscaped's precision-engineered tools are optimized specifically for below-the-waist grooming and hygiene. I love their Lawnmower 2.0 trimmer with skin-safe ceramic blades, a nick-free manscaping experience every time. So keep the inside of your briefs like Bischoff's briefs. Go to manscaped.com and get 20% off and free shipping with discount code ESPN. That's code ESPN for 20% off and free shipping.
You're listening to Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff, brought to you by Boyd Gaming.
There's a twist on it.
It did.
A twist, and it's
it turned it around.
We should have thought of that.
We were so...
But it's still a stupid...
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever.
Yeah, it's just
clever.
A little turnabout.
Tyler Bischoff is technically correct.
Gold Knights blew it, Jared. They could have won, but they didn't. They blew it. 3-2 lead in the third period. All right, we have not had Spanish goal calls in quite a while. So let's go ahead and play the first one. Here is Nate Schmidt's goal, which is actually off the skate of, who was it off of? I can't remember, somebody for Columbus. Here's Nate Schmidt's goal and Jesus Lopez return to Spanish goal calls.
De Columbus que tiene que irse arriba holgadamente dos o tres goles para poder llevarse el triunfo aquí de la T-Mobile Arena. Se ve el equipo de Vegas Golden Knights. Vamos a ver hacia el centro. ¡Gol!
Apenas si lo celebraba el equipo visitante. Yo creo que tuvieron muy poco tiempo para digerirlo. Para...
So Fleury was bad in this game. It felt like one of the worst games he's ever played for Vegas. He gave up a goal in which the puck got put behind the net. He went back to play it. It bounced off the boards right out in front, and he was nowhere near the net to try to make a save on Artemi Panarin. The game-tying goal, he let the puck, it wasn't even a shot, just let a loose puck roll up his stick over his pad and sit in the crease without really controlling it or knocking away, and Cam Atkinson tapped it in. And then on the game winner, you probably give more credit to Cam Atkinson for the shot itself because he put it in the top corner, but Fleury did have a view of him and got beat short side. He usually doesn't really get beat on a shot that's coming straight on with no real deflection or anything like that. So Fleury wasn't good, and I've pointed out, you know, his stats have been kind of average this year, but I think it makes you realize that we take Fleury for granted because you almost never walk away from a Golden Knights game thinking, wow, a better goalie, and they win that game. Like, that never happens. Like, Fleury's been, like, even when he's just average, you're never like, oh, yeah, a better goalie wins that game. Like, but you did it after that one, and it's rare. And it happens a lot in the NHL, but it hasn't happened to Fleury since he's been in Vegas. Like, the Penguins got rid of him because he wasn't very good his last year in Pittsburgh, but since he's been here, he's been excellent. You haven't had many games like that. So what's important for the Golden Knights in the future is Fleury in the playoffs. You get that performance out of Fleury in the playoffs, they don't have a chance. They don't have a chance. But he's got a chance to be the best goalie, best player on the ice in every single series they play. And if he is, they'll probably win every series that he's the best player. That's how it's going to be with Marc-Andre Fleury.
Would it be crazy to give Subban more reps?
No, they definitely need to.
Okay.
They should have played him in that game and the next one. Like, yeah, that's the thing. Like, the Golden Knights are going to be in the playoffs. They're going to be in the 2-3 matchup in the Pacific Division. That's what's going to happen. Vancouver is not going to catch them. Vancouver's not very good. They're not going to catch them. They don't need to be worried about winning every individual regular season game. They need to be worried about what's best for the playoffs, and Marc-Andre Fleury getting rest in the final, what do they have, 20-something games left, is important. Like, he needs to be refreshed for the playoffs.
Can they put him on, like, an every third?
Every third game? Good Lord. Gerard Gallant loses his mind. He only plays him once every three games?
Yeah.
Ridiculous. So, yeah, but no, they need to. Like, I think they need to, and there's a chance they might because their playoff spot is a little bit more solidified than it was earlier in the year, and that was apparently the thought process. But yeah, they get Fleury needs to be the best player in the playoffs for them to win, and so that's what's most important. Give me John Merrill's goal. Shorthanded John Merrill goal.
A punto de caer el puck. Face off. Costado derecho de la portería, Marc-Andre Fleury. Ahí está buscando Ed Schmidt y lo saca. Y se viene el equipo de Vegas Golden Knights. Ese es Riley Smith por izquierda. Riley Smith. El pase. Paso que no pueda. Llega uno más. ¡Gol! Y estimado que el campo. ¡Qué jugada! ¡Qué despegue!
La jugada es espectacular.
Spectacular. So the other point from that game, Gerard Gallant's coaching. Like the whole, like last season, didn't feel like Gerard Gallant coached. And like I'm over exaggerating, but like you talk to him in press conferences and he says he doesn't coach. He's like, oh, I didn't make that decision. Ask my other coaches. Like it seemed like he didn't coach, but he's actually coaching now. So he benched two forwards for the entire third period. And we do not see that often from Gerard Gallant. We have seen like Brandon Peary bench for the final 5 minutes of games, but not for the entire third period. He benched Valentin Zhukov and Tomáš Nosek. So for the third period, the Golden Knights only had three lines. Their first and second lines as usual, and then four guys rotating through on the third line, Eakin and Belmar, and then they rotated through Reeves and Carrier. It's not really a crazy coaching tactic. Like NHL coaches will bench their worst forwards. I don't know about for the whole third period, but they'll bench their worst lines. They'll double shift their top lines. But it is rare for the Golden Knights. Like, we just haven't seen this. And what I think might be the bigger point overall is I buy into the theory that the Golden Knights are good not because they have, like, top-end talent that can outplay the rest of the league, but because their worst players are often much better than the other team's worst players. Like, the Golden Knights, like, Gerard Gallant, for the entirety of the Golden Knights' existence, has trusted his third and fourth lines. Like, there's never been a point where he's afraid to put them on the ice because they're going to get torched by some other line. Like, he'll be smart about it and not play them max minutes against Connor McDavid or something like that. But, like, he's always had trust in his third and fourth lines. And a lot of other teams don't. Their fourth lines, they don't want them anywhere out there. But the Golden Knights, they're worst. It's that, what's the cliche? You're only as strong as your weakest link, right? Like that's.
See, I was going to make the metaphor. The ceiling may not be very high, but at least the floor is.
Seems like a terrible room to be in.
Oh, it's a bad room, but like the ceiling is the ceiling, but the floor is pretty high.
But what you have now is there's a lack of trust with Peary in close games when he's in the lineup.
Can't score, fraud.
He's a fraud. Maybe it's just one game with Zhukov and Nosek, but there's a lack of trust with those two guys in that one game. So I think that takes away a potential strength for the Golden Knights. And the question, like if you look into the future, what the hell's the third line going to be? That's still a question, and it's probably more glaring than ever when you bench two of the guys that were on the third line. It seems as though Gallant is committed to Cody Eakin being a center, so he's sort of cemented into that spot. You've got to find two other guys to play around him. And again, Peary and Zhukov is your potential offensive upside options, and it's Noshik, Carpenter, Lindbergh is your potential safer defensive options. They got to find a combo that works. There is one other thing he could do, because we saw him play Eakin and Belmar together and rotate Carrier and Reeves. Potentially, he could make it the third line Belmar, Eakin, and then whatever, Carrier, right? Make that the third line, and then your fourth line is just some random combination of like Noshik centering Reeves and Peary or Zhukov or whatever it is. That probably gives you your best possible three lines, but your fourth line is just a mess. So like in that scenario, you'd probably have three good lines and they'd be benching that fourth line all the time. That might be what's best, but they got to figure out what's going to happen with the third line or in that scenario, what would be the fourth line. All right, give me the Cody Eakin goal, and we're going to break. We're going to give away lights tickets. We're going to have the Raiders in their stadium, but give me Cody Eakin in Spanish.
Un disparo que pasa por un costado de la portería de Marc-André Fleury. Y ahí está el robo, se viene Belmer. Belmer por izquierda, Belmer, Belmer, Belmer. El pase, el disparo. Una descolgada relampagueante de Ever Castro.
Tenía que ser así, un contragolpe de ese tipo a esa velocidad.
Check out the podcast on lvsportsnetwork.com.
There's no I in team. Yeah, there's no you either. So I guess if I'm not on the team and you're not on the team, nobody's on the goddamn team. The team sucks.
It's Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff.
All right, we are giving away Lights FC tickets. They play the Colorado Rapids on Saturday. It's a Major League Soccer team. And we've got tickets to give out. We have five pair of tickets. We have posted. This is what you need to do to win tickets. We have posted on Twitter and Facebook asking for jokes. Technically, they can be about anything. I would prefer they be about me or the show or Lights FC. Or Eric Winalda, because
Eric Winalda said he was, you know, he's looking for comedians.
Yeah, he is. So we'll give him comedians. So because Winalda is going to be in studio tomorrow, and we're going to pick some of these best ones with Eric Winalda, and then those people will win tickets. So Facebook and Twitter, it's ESPN Las Vegas on Facebook. I posted on my Twitter account, but it's the ESPN Las Vegas Twitter account too. Give us your jokes about. It can be about anything, but Lights FC, me, Eric Winalda, the show, whatever you want. And we'll pick the best ones with Eric Winalda tomorrow. People will win tickets. I'll be here at 10:15 tomorrow. We'll yell at him about taking shots at UNLV, too. But we got some Raiders to get to. We got some stadium news update. But first, we have our breaking news on the Raiders stadium.
With the NFL season only
4,104 hours
away, Technically Correct can exclusively report that the Raiders will play their 2019 season at
Maracana Stadium in Rio de Janeiro, the site of the 2016 Olympic Games, with a stadium capacity of 87,000. They shouldn't have any scheduling issues at Maracana Stadium because it was described like this from Business Insider. At the Maracana Stadium, the power has been turned off because there is nobody to pay the energy bill. Water in one practice pool is orange. Turf has turned brown and, along with countless stadium seats, inexplicably removed from the field. They should be used to playing on brown field, though.
Yeah.
All right. Fits right in. They'll be perfect. I bet rent will be a lot cheaper there.
Exactly.
All right.
Deep flights might be a bit of a problem.
We do have an actual, like, serious report on the Raiders Stadium Quest.
Is it serious? Because I read two of these articles, and it just was like a conversation has happened.
Yeah. Well, I meant serious in the fact that we didn't just
throw a dart at a map.
And pick what's the closest stadium. That's where they're playing. This is from Larry Beal of ABC7 in San Francisco. The Raiders are in negotiations with the Oakland Coliseum to play the 2019 season at the Coliseum. It's apparently the first time they've talked since Oakland decided to sue the Raiders back in December. So this is so great on both sides because you have Oakland suing the Raiders in the NFL because they feel like they got cheated out of their NFL team. Like, they think the NFL broke its own rules and didn't operate in good faith when the Raiders were given permission to move to Vegas. Like, that's what they believe. That's what they're suing the NFL and the Raiders over. And they don't want to force the Raiders to stay. They just want the Raiders to have to leave the name Raiders in Oakland. So that's one side of it. The other side is Mark Davis, who said he will not play there because, well, they're suing him. That seems pretty logical. Like, yeah, you're going to sue me. I'm not playing there. But he has no other option now, apparently, except to pay the 49ers rent. And he definitely doesn't want to pay the 49ers rent because the 49ers just blocked him from going and playing at the San Francisco Giants Stadium. So now he wants to go back. It's okay. It's amazing because it's an ugly divorce. But they still have to live together. Like, they got divorced 2 years ago. They've been living together for 2 years. It's at its height of ugliness right now, but they still might have to live together for another year. It's incredible.
Okay, so let's do the math real quick. They want $7 million to play at the falling apart Coliseum.
Yeah, the RJ reported that the offer from the Coliseum is to pay rent for the 2019 season. It was either $7 or $7.5 million.
And it cost $5 million to make Sam Boyd NFL ready.
Probably too late now, but conceivably that could have been done.
I'm just saying.
Yeah, no, it would have made a lot more sense. But they don't. They want a grand entrance to the city of Las Vegas. They don't want to play a dumpy Sam Boyd stadium. They don't want to lose money just putting it into Sam Boyd, which has to, by law, has to close once the Raiders come here, because God forbid there be competition for events at that stadium.
You suck, Tyler.